Oh, hi. So my name is David Malin, and I'm very loud at the moment. This is Computer Science 50. For those of you who are joining us for the first time, there are syllabi still available outside. That is the only handout from Monday and today. If you're still considering shopping this course, what I thought I'd do was just read a few excerpts from some choice Q-Guide comments from this past year that speak to a couple of the aspects of the course's reputation, its workload, its fun factor, and so forth. And this one student wrote, and it's a good soundbite, if nothing else, "I learned so much, it boggles my mind." So I'll leave that one with you. This fellow elaborated, "As the TFs in this course will repeatedly tell you, this class is what you make of it. For me, the course was hugely rewarding, engaging, and entertaining, but I devoted an enormous amount of my time to it. The best advice I was given was to start problem sets early and to reach out to at least one TF other than my own section leader. It's possible to go this class alone if you're really good, or in my case, really stubborn, but I could have saved myself a lot of sleepless nights early on if I had simply sought help. It is abundant." And lastly, and this is my favorite of the 300 plus write-ups that we got last year in terms of choice quotes, because it is true, or at least it was for me 10 years ago, and it was, I think, for some of our students last semester. "The workload was, I guess, fairly substantial. But before CS50, I'd never walked home to my dorm at 4 a.m. grinning from ear to ear after I'd finished a PSET simply because it was so cool and I was so pleased and proud of myself." So I do think that is a sentiment shared, if you can dare believe it, by more than one student in this course historically. So I challenge you not to feel that way on at least one occasion out of the course's 9 problem sets later this semester. So today we dive into computer science and into programming. We focus specifically today on this programming language, this programming environment known as Scratch, which was actually developed a couple of years ago down the road by MIT's Media Lab. We dive in on Monday to a language known as C, where we'll spend much of our time this semester. Even those of you who are coming into the course with a background in AP computer science, Java, or the like, what you'll find that we're able to do with C and languages like it is get much more lower level, much closer to the hardware, so to speak, than some of those other high-level languages, so to speak, allow for. Later in the semester, we'll build our way up and up and up until we get to sort of the more high-level languages like PHP, which is all the rage these days in terms of website development. If any of you have ever used Facebook, it's what much of Facebook is written in, although supposedly some of the underlying optimizations are actually done in C and C++ and other languages still. And then after that, not only will we introduce a query language called SQL, which is used for querying databases, we will also look at some object-oriented programming by way of JavaScript. So the original course catalog, if you noticed in print, mentioned C++. We decided at the last minute to swap that out for JavaScript at course's end so that we can focus, for instance, on mashups in particular. And so I'd be remiss if I did not fix our one gaffe from Monday, which was these particular demonstrations. This time I had the foresight to actually test them in advance. Apparently the computer wants me to step on it. This is a web page that's a very simple demonstration of one of Google's plugins, because again, Google is appealing in many ways from our perspective as a course, largely because of the APIs, the application programming interfaces that they allow. What does that mean? Just means they provide code for the world to use so that people can make things like this without having to implement every aspect of it themselves. All right, so the computer is getting antsy. This is a web page with the relatively new Google Earth plugin, and we, I believe, are in Google's campus right now, and literally through their campus. And much of the world is flat out there, but that's only because the computer can't keep up with downloading all of the satellite imagery. A little more interesting, if we do it a little slower, is this one. So same plugin. This too is implemented in JavaScript and with some other tools provided by Google to whoever made the simulator. And what I thought I'd do is sort of take the idea of Google Maps one step further and show you that on the right is in fact an embedded Google Map, which we've all probably used. On the left is this relatively new Google Earth plugin. And what I thought I'd do is find us directions from, say, 1 Oxford Street in Cambridge, Mass, which is roughly where we are. That's the Science Center. And we'll go to, say, 77 Massachusetts Avenue in Cambridge, Mass, which is MIT's big main entrance. So let's see what this does for us. So I'm going to click Go. It's apparently loading directions off the interwebs. There, it's zooming in, hopefully on the Science Center. Good, we've got some 3D satellite imagery there. I'm going to go ahead and click Start, just to give you a sense of what you even could do by making use of Google's publicly available APIs and other companies like it to do a simulation like this. So notice this particular milk truck is not only driving on the map, You're also getting the satellite imagery as well, and any latency is purely the fault of my laptop here, and not so much the code itself. So that must be us going down Mass Ave awfully fast, and if we zoom in, there in fact is MIT. So it's really cool, frankly, what you can do relatively easily these days. Case in point, on Monday, like Shuttleboy's GPS integration, it wasn't all that much code to create this interface that's particularly interesting. And not to dwell on Google too much, but only because they have some neat stuff out there. Google Chrome, this new browser that just came out recently, if you go to About Internets, plural, you'll find that some programmer late at night or some team thought it'd be funny to embed an Easter egg in this little program, perhaps to pat Senator Ted Stevens on the back. If you hit enter on About Internets, you get nothing because the tubes are clogged. So, example of someone perhaps with a little too much free time. So today we introduce Scratch and we introduce programming and some computer science constructs by way of Scratch. For some of these ideas will be old hat because you've seen them before. But toward the end of today, we'll use this same relatively simple programming environment to introduce some topics you simply tend not to get to in most introductory courses. Ideas like multi-threading and event handling and similar constructs will we be able to introduce much sooner than you could in a traditional course. This is Scratch. It's a free download, works on Macs and PCs. It's again developed by MIT. Quick 5-second overview. This is the so-called stage at top right, where sort of everything will happen. In this stage, can you have multiple sprites, characters of sorts, depicted here at bottom right. In the middle of this screen is where the scripts for each of these characters, each of these sprites go. Because as I hinted on Monday, you program in Scratch by way of dragging and dropping these puzzle pieces that fit together not only in terms of their shape, but also logically, so far as we're concerned. And on the far left here, do we have a sort of palette of all of the building blocks that we can drag and drop. And you'll see, again, if you're familiar with programming already, ideas like loops and conditions and branches and similar ideas there embedded in what are otherwise fairly user-friendly puzzle pieces. So this is perhaps my other pride and joy when it comes to things done late on a Friday night when all my friends were doing cooler things. This is Oscar time, and this is what I made when I actually was a grad student cross-registered at MIT when I met the folks at the Media Lab who had invented this language, and they were trying it out on us at the time before they debuted it for the world. And I thought rather than my sort of embarrassing myself with my little program here, I'd ask for a volunteer to do that instead, if we could get one such volunteer from this otherwise darkened room. Yeah, come on down. What's your name? Sorry? Hansa? Okay, come on down. All right. Oh, and you do have to sign your life away on this legal form afterwards since we're on multiple cameras here. So this is Oscar time. This is an example of Scratch. It's about a 90-second program, which in retrospect was about 60 seconds too long if you're doing this late at night. All you're going to have to do is I'm going to click the green flag in the top right-hand corner, which is like the go button. These directions sort of say it all. Trash will start falling from the sky, and your goal with the keypad, trackpad here is just to click on the trash, drag it to the trash can, let go, and try to keep up. Make sense? All right. It's just you and me. No one else out there. Here we go.
Thank you.
Congratulations. Let me just give you this. Thank you. So I hope you can sort of appreciate now that choosing a 90-plus second song is cute maybe the first time, but not the 86th time when you're trying to debug a program like this. So retrospect, bad idea. So a couple of announcements before we forge ahead. Is our friend Josh from HCS here at the moment? Yes, Josh is a member of the Harvard Computer Society, which is an organization on campus that is rather apropos for this group here.
Can I steal your mic?
Probably best just to speak into me.
All right. Well, the Harvard Computer Society is a group on campus devoted to promoting technology and computers and computing and computer science. We do a number of projects and run a number of events on campus which are sort of relevant, whether you just like programming, whether you like CS research, whether you are interested in entrepreneurship. We're hopefully going to be an interesting organization for you. Our alumni have gone on to do everything from becoming CS professors, to becoming doctors and lawyers, to becoming the first CTO of Google, to teaching CS50. So, and that includes both Professor Malin himself and, of course, many of your TFs. We are having our introductory meeting tonight, actually, from 8 to 10 in Hillis 307. And, of course, if you'd like, you can meet us at about 7:45 at the John Harvard statue, and we'll walk up as a big group up there tonight. We have a nice office up there. It should be a lot of fun. We'll go over some of the stuff we do, and then we'll start our regular session of events. You can also join our mailing list by visiting our website, which is hcs.harvard.edu.
All right. Thanks very much, Josh. So I actually do owe those guys a lot. I sort of got started in teaching really because of HCS. I had, long story short, sophomore, junior year, sort of made either the big decision or the big mistake to run for UC president of all things. And I lost miserably. In no small part due to my lack of public speaking abilities at the time. And so what I actually did at the time was I joined HCS so as to become, ironically, a teacher. They have for years held these seminars of sorts, introductory courses on how to use the web or how to use email, how to use Unix, how to use various text editors and so forth, and I thought this would be a fun way to not only sort of teach something I was fundamentally comfortable with, but also to sort of work on the butterflies and such that had so derailed me, along with perhaps all of my positions at the time. So that is where I got my start with all this stuff, and if you're at all interested in that kind of stuff or geeking out to an extent, do check them out. It's a fun group. So this is what a typical program looks like. This is the programming language known as C, and there's a lot of syntax there. There's a lot of interesting formatting, curly braces and parentheses and semicolons, and this is representative of a lot of languages, whether it's C, C++, Java, Perl, PHP, a lot of the modern programming languages, and there's just a lot here for sort of day one, and it's not all that stimulating to dive into the historical reasons as to why it's called argc and what argv represents. So rather, we decided last year in this course to begin with this other environment known as Scratch, which allows us to explore these very same ideas, but just in a much more user-friendly way, if you will. Because what ultimately happens when writing a traditional program at the command line, that is a blinking prompt with your keyboard, is you run that source code, so to speak, this sort of English-like syntax through a program called a compiler, and that compiler converts what appears to be sort of pseudo-English into what's called object code or byte codes, which is really patterns of zeros and ones that a computer understands. And in fact, this is far fewer zeros and ones than are actually outputted by a typical program, hence the dot, dot, dot. But these are literally the sequences of zeros and ones that are spit out. If I write that program up top, even with something simple like Notepad or TextEdit on any computer, and then compile it using a program like Visual Studio or GCC, if you've heard of these things, but very quickly does sort of the ideas under there, do the ideas under there become a little less interesting? And so what we thought we'd do today is sort of start with the same constructs, but a more friendly environment. But first, a few announcements of our own. So I thought we would try this tradition on Fridays. Instead of having lectures, we'd instead have sort of office hours during lunch. If you're all interested in joining me and one or more teaching fellows this Friday from 1:15 to 2:30, just drop an email to rsvp@cs50.net so we can plan seating accordingly. And do feel free to join us, and please don't feel scared, since there's also comments like those in the Q Guide writings every year. Too scared to go to office hours and such. Sectioning will happen next week, so there's no sections this week or next week, though we will have office hours, as you'll see on the website, tomorrow, next Tuesday, and next Thursday with respect to problems at zero. An issue of printouts. I think we will figure this out as we go. One of the survey questions we asked last year was, could we as a course get away with not printing, using so much paper and getting rid of printed lecture slides? We go through dozens of reams of paper sometimes for one lecture, and it's just very wasteful, since I know as well as you that a lot of that paper just ends up sitting in your binder or nowhere at all. But what we thought we'd do, at least initially as a compromise, is make sure to post all of the handouts in sort of a printer-friendly black and white format on the website before lecture. So if you're that type of student who does like to come to class and be able to take notes right on the slides, they'll be available, and we'll see how well this works. And again, this is really just in the interests of being green. Finally, I should have disclaimed the other day, if you've gotten into the habit already of making your way around campus using ShuttleBoy, it's kind of not up to date. So I haven't really gotten around to updating the schedules for 2008 yet. It's on the to-do list, but you might be a year or so late if you're waiting for the shuttle at some of those stops. So it'll get updated. It's just some of this stuff has taken priority instead. So with that said, let's present some basic ideas, most of which should be self-explanatory, and then quickly forge ahead to sort of a more interesting construct. So an algorithm, or a procedure. This is kind of something that a computer, even a human, can do. It's a set of steps that instructs some entity, like a human or a computer, to do something. So here's a silly algorithm, an algorithm with which one might put his or her socks on in the morning. And we use this really just to tease out some basic ideas that we'll now see in a different context, and we'll soon see in a different context altogether. So in line one, I sort of am initializing myself or my mental count of how many socks I have on to zero. So that thing up in the top line there, let socks on feet equal zero, that's what we'd call a variable. It's sort of more interesting named than in algebra, like x, y, or z. And that's useful in programming, as we'll see, because you tend to use many such variables in programs. So I initialize, so to speak, that variable, that mental count to zero. And now two, I'm inducing this very basic idea of a loop, something that's going to happen again and again until some task is completed. Well, what am I going to continue doing until I'm all done? Well, in step three, I'm apparently going to open a sock drawer, look for a sock. If I find a sock, then, and as the indentation suggests, all the rest of this stuff should now happen in series. I'm going to put on that sock, then I'm going to do socks on feet plus plus. I'm sort of stealing syntax from C in Java here. What does that mean? You can even guess. Just add one, right? So plus plus is syntax we'll see quite often. That just means plus plus. So that means now socks on feet is initialized to one. In step eight, I'm now going to do whatever it takes to look for a matching sock. And now in lines 9 and 13, we have an instance of what's called a condition or a branch, a so-called fork in the road, where if one thing is true, I'm going to go off this way and do some stuff. If something else is true, or rather that thing's false, I'm going to go off in this direction and do some other stuff. Well, what am I going to do if I find a matching sock? I'm going to put on that matching sock. I'm going to do plus plus on my variable, close sock drawer. And then because of the indentation, the implication is now I'm done because I'm going to finish up by going back to that loop. So in step two, it said, while socks on feet, bang equals, exclamation point, computer scientists say bang, just because it's easier than saying exclamation point equals. So bang equals two is at this point true or false, that statement. Are socks on feet not equal to two? No, it is equal to two, because I just put on the first sock, found the matching sock, and did plus plus, and so now I have two matching socks, and so that loop terminates, that loop exits, and we're done. Well, now let's see if we can push a little harder here. Is there a situation in which we will get stuck in, let's call it, an infinite loop, where I just keep churning and churning away, doing something stupid, and you as a human quite easily realize that you're never going to stop doing that? What could go wrong here? Yeah. Good. So if there's no matching socks in the drawer, what's going to happen? Well, let's roll back the story. In step five, when I first began, I found presumably a sock. So I put it on, I do plus plus, so my total count is one. Now I'm looking for a matching sock. Well, what's going to happen? Well, I'm not, according to your assumption in step nine, going to find a matching sock, and so I execute the else, the other fork in the road, which says remove first sock from foot. Socks on feet, minus minus, no surprise. That means go back down to zero. And then again, because of the indentation, it means I'm going to go back to the while socks on feet not equal to two, because I'm in this loop conceptually. And socks on feet is indeed not equal to two, because it's back to zero. So what am I going to do at that point? Same thing again. right? And like an idiot, I'm going to put on a sock, take off the sock, put it on, take it off, put it on, and this is an infinite loop. And you know, this is a silly contrived example, but if you've ever used your Mac or PC and you find that it hasn't crashed per se, it's still kind of sort of responsive, but it's deathly slow. It takes seconds just to change from one window to another. Well, quite possibly some human has made a mistake in one of the programs they wrote that you're running on your computer, whether it's your browser, a Microsoft Word, AOL Instant Messenger, and because of someone's mistake or someone's failure to sort of anticipate some weird corner case, like maybe you don't have two matching socks, can that program just churn and churn away, trying to do something, who knows what, but it's never going to stop. And so what's the solution in the real world with your computer to that particular problem? Right, that's like the Control-Alt-Delete. Right, that sort of like walk away from the problem, shut the computer down. I mean, that's sort of a very common recourse these days. So these silly kinds of mistakes, you will see, are not uncommon to any of our code. I mean, even I, every time I sit down and write some code, with high probability do I make some mistake or fail to anticipate some particular bug. In fact, I can think back even as far as Shuttle Boy. I, sadly, was working on Shuttle Boy on New Year's Eve No, actually, that's a complete lie. It wouldn't have been 2000. So I was working on Shuttle Boy on New Year's Eve because I was home with my family. Let's assume we live in the middle of nowhere and therefore it was okay not to go out and do something fun. Connecticut's like that sometimes. And I realized only because the clock told midnight that I had some bug because I, like much of the world, had made the mistake at that point to only use like a single digit to keep track of the year, or two digits. And I, too, was sort of suffered some kind of date-related bug, which wasn't Y2K per se, but it was something stupid. And so mark our words, you will absolutely write code and more code and more code that the first time around probably does not work. But as that student said, it's when it does roll around to 4 a.m. and you've sort of stuck it out because, damn, you've spent 10 hours on this problem, so you're not going to give up just yet. It's an incredibly gratifying experience to say, wow, this works, and I made this, which is unlike a lot of problem sets. I challenge you to walk home so proudly having just solved some calculus problem and feel that same sense of satisfaction. So, what can we do now when it comes to programming with Scratch? So this is complete blasphemy, first of all. So the canonical string, the canonical sentence to use in an introductory computer science course is, hello world, because this is the sentence that appears in some of the earliest computer science texts. Well, we're trying to sex things up this year, so we'll go with the more the lolcat type oh hi, for instance, here. So how do you go about programming in Scratch when you don't have these prefab programs? Well, with Scratch, we're going to load this program up, click New, and you're just going to get this clean slate. You're going to get one sprite, Scratch the cat by default, though you can change him with different costumes and make him look completely different, clearly. You have an empty palette here for all of your scripts, no other sprites, and here you have all the building blocks that you can actually use. Well, creating a program is going to boil down to dragging and dropping some puzzle pieces that respond to your initial click of this green flag, which is sort of like executing or running the program. So if I just want this guy to say something, and I just happen to know where all the blocks are already, I'm just going to drag this over here and say something like, oh, hi, for 2 seconds, and that's all it takes to write a program in Scratch. And I argue it's more interesting than doing the same kind of thing at the command line and just seeing some blank line of text. But we can do more interesting things still. So what are some of the basic ideas that we can pull out of Scratch and then build on top of to make more complicated things still? So in programming in general, there's this notion of a statement, which is an instruction, a command, that makes the computer do something, usually some predefined task that someone else empowered the computer to do. So for instance, in this course, you yourself won't write the very low-level code that teaches the computer that when it has 65, the value in memory, that it should display an A. Rather, you can take for granted that someone else dealt with that. So if you want to display an A, you just write print A, essentially. Well, here we have in Scratch some similar type constructs. You can say things. We'll see this is the analog of printing to the screen in a real program. Wait 1 second, so sort of pause, play sound like a meow. So let's use these for real. So we have on the course's website all of the code that I'll play around here today, just that we don't dwell too long on writing some of the most basics. So let me go ahead and open a second instance of Scratch with this simple program. And notice that you can just stack these things again and again, and they nicely snap together no matter how many you try to cram together. Now, already, though, there seems to be an opportunity for an optimization here. Because what did I clearly do when writing this? Well, I clearly dragged one such piece, then another such piece, and then I just kind of did the whole copy-paste thing, which doesn't really scale very well. And so one of the topics we'll discuss in the course, and you'll learn sort of by way of example often, is style, and talking about what sort of makes good programming practices and what sort of violates what most people would consider conventional. So let's see if we can't improve upon what's really here, just a copy-paste job of something still that's a pretty boring program. So this one here, at least, gets a little more interesting, if only because... All right, so a little chuckle. It's clear, programming's clearly getting more interesting already. So can we do better than that? Well, we can if we start to give ourselves more means of expression. If we can sort of integrate into a program not just statements, one after the other, which are very deterministic. That program, no matter how many times I run, it's going to do the same thing again and again and again. And most programs like that, not so useful. Most every program you use on your computer takes some form of input or does something conditionally based on what you type, based on the time of day, based on what someone else types on their screen. So we have this notion in programming of what's called a Boolean expression, named after a gentleman by the last name of Boole. And a Boolean expression is simply sort of like a mathematical construct that evaluates, so to speak, to either true or false, one or zero, or however you want to view those two sides of the world. So for instance, in Scratch, we have Boolean expressions like touching mouse pointer question mark, and with that, can you have a sprite sort of ask itself, am I touching the mouse pointer? Or equivalently, is the mouse pointer, the arrow, touching me? Because if so, maybe the program should respond to that kind of input. Question mark, mouse down. That's going to either be a true statement or a false statement. So true, false. It's a Boolean expression. You can do more interesting things with these green blocks in Scratch. You can say, is something less than something? So there's these mathematical basics, too. And then there's also Boolean operators like oring things together, OR, or anding things together to say that this and this must be true in order for the program to proceed. Now, these are useful if we integrate them into what are called conditions. So a condition, which is something we saw on the silly little sock example, is like a fork in the road or an optional branch that you might take. So if something is true, such as at top left here, go and do the stuff that's inside this particular puzzle piece. Or you might say, if something's true, do this, else do that. And what's nice about these building blocks, as well as most programming languages themselves, is you can kind of stack these things conceptually. So it doesn't have to be a fork with just one and two directions. It can be a three-way street. It can be a four-way street just by nesting them. So what this is clearly saying is if, else, do this. So you have sort of three things that you can do. Well, let's actually do something with this. The first one, a little trivial, but let's see what happens. So when I click the green flag here, softball question, what is going to happen? All right, it's going to meow. So long as one is still less than two, the program will, in fact, meow for us. All right, completely underwhelming. But let's now introduce something that's sort of unique to computers, and humans, I suppose, is the ability to sort of pick a number from 1 to 10. Now, a computer can do this not so much by picking a number from 1 to 10 off the top of its head, because it doesn't really have, most computers, independent thought. So there's some kind of interesting mathematics going on underneath the hood that sort of simulate the idea of randomness. And this is a whole research area of computer science using machines that literally only do what they're told to, but using them in such a way that maybe they take some random input, or maybe they use the time of day and somehow jumble it together so they spit out what appears to be a random number. This is what we mean when we say pseudo-randomness, using a deterministic device, a machine, to create the illusion of just pick a number off the top of your head. So when I click the green flag now, what's going to happen here? It's good. So we don't know, but we can at least claim with 50% probability that this thing is going to meow. Okay? Okay. Oh. Oh, good. So 50-50, right? It's always a bad demo when it does it like six times in a row, just probabilistically. So that can happen too. But that one seems to check out. All right. So interesting. Let's build further. All right. So we've got now the idea of statements, which just do something. We've got Boolean expressions, which are either true or false. We can then use those in conditions to do something optionally. What if we want to do something again and again? Well, we have the idea of loops. And in Scratch, these take the form of, for instance, a forever block, which literally means throw as much stuff as you want inside this block, and it will just go happen again and again and again and again. And notice that even though this block is rather small, these things, if you didn't notice, resize themselves automatically to fit more and more information, but they maintain the same shape. So let's do something now with a loop here. So let's go ahead and redo what was otherwise a very simple example before, a very naive approach of just copy-paste. So this thing now. You'll never have a more annoying demo if I just completely walk off the stage at this point. So that's all that's going to do ad nauseum. So how does this actually piece together? Well, what's also neat about Scratch, unlike most languages, is you can actually interact with it in real time. You don't have to recompile your program. You don't have to make all of your changes and then test it. You can literally try things as you go. And so what happens here is if I put this thing in, bad idea. But the piece will resize as you request. Well, can we do something a little more interesting and make these programs actually something you might care to show someone? Well, what about this one? I'm going to hit play, and nothing seems to happen until what? Yeah. So this is telling the sprite, it forever, keep checking the following, forever, keep checking this. If you're touching the mouse pointer, my arrow there, play the sound and then wait 2 seconds. So let's see what happens. Aww. If you want the setup, this is like petting a cat, so yeah, see, that makes it cute. Okay, good, but still kind of lame. So can we do better? Well, this one has a two-directional branch, so the cat's purring away, completely content, and now this is the kind of cat where if you go and touch it, so it gets a little more interesting. And incidentally, there are fun things that we're not going to dwell on in lecture, certainly, even though they are wonderfully fun to sort of veer off on tangents on. But there are features like, again, costumes where you can put different pictures on these things, play with them, resize them. You even have the equivalent of like Mac Paint where you can draw things yourself by hand. There are sounds that come with this thing. And this is, again, just to sort of encourage you to run with this. We've got, for instance, in the human folder. You can just kind of hear the grad students in the media lab recording these into mics, perhaps against their will. And there's a couple other good ones. I swear, you will play with this for a few minutes.
Join us.
So, and there's others still. So, where the hell were we? All right, so. So we now have the ability to loop and do something conditionally, but potentially again and again. Can we now retain state? Can we remember information that maybe has been provided by the user or has been the result of, say, incrementing some counter? Well, Scratch also supports the idea of variables, which, just like algebra, is just a placeholder for some piece of information. Well, what kind of information might we store? Well, in Scratch, you're for the most part limited to storing numbers, although you can also store strings, like words or sentences. Well, let's take a look at how this one, for instance, works. So count1.sb is the name of this one. Let me go ahead and play this. So this is my counting sheep example. Play this one long enough and you will go to sleep. That's all it does, right? It's just going to count up to whatever the largest possible number is that Scratch supports. Well, how does that work? Well, notice that, one, I have this orange block here that says set counter to zero. Well, just to set the stage here, this panel here with variables, well, these are just all the building blocks that you can use to actually interact with variables. You can make a variable, delete a variable, and then you can do things like set it to some value, change it by some value, show or hide it, so you can actually show these things on the screen when debugging to actually see what it is, although clearly not useful in this case.
case if the sheep is telling us what it is. But then notice we have some of the same building blocks. A forever loop, it's just saying what the current variable is for 1 second. So notice that variables can be dragged and dropped where otherwise text might otherwise go. It's going to wait. It's going to increment the counter like a plus plus and then proceed. Well, let's build on that. What if instead I introduce some pseudo-randomness and let Scratch sort of decide for itself what it wants to do? Well, in this case here, why did it do that? What's this program designed to do? So this thing's only going to go bah with 50% probability, right? So same idea, but now at least we're integrating the idea of conditions with variables so that we can not only use a number sort of pseudo-randomly, but we can keep it around by setting with this orange block that variable name to be some value. So again, we've got a 50-50 chance here. There we go. So the pseudo-randomness seems to check out, 50-50, though rarely does that actually happen. So let's build up more interestingly, right? It's not all that hard to wrap your mind around the idea of variables and statements and conditions and loops. Well, what if you actually want to do things that are a little more interactive? Maybe you want to implement like a role-playing game, an RPG, that you actually walk around various screens and you collect things. And you want to collect things by tossing them into like an inventory or your pouch, like a lot of these kinds of RPG games. Well, with arrays or vectors, or lists, which are related but slightly different from each other, can you do just that? It's not just this bucket for one number, but rather it's sort of an array, if you will, of numbers or strings. It's a list that you can maintain. And in Scratch, these things called arrays are actually more properly called vectors because they automatically resize, which is to say if you have one thing that you need to store, that array will be of size 1. If you've got two things, it's going to grow to accommodate that. Three things, it's going to grow further. If you get rid of something, it will shrink down effectively. And so that's what really a vector is. In C, as we'll see next week, though, C doesn't really have out of the box vectors and this ability to automatically resize. You'll see we're so close to the hardware, you're going to have to implement that kind of dynamism yourself. In Scratch, it's going to do it for us, so we'll slap the label arrays here on them, but just realize that they'll be slightly different from what we get with C. So what can we actually do with something like this? Well, suppose we have this construct here, which is excerpted actually from one of the examples that ships with Scratch. So apparently when I receive quote unquote outside, this is actually a foreshadowing of something called an event that we'll talk about in a moment, I'm going to show myself. So the purple block just means let the sprite appear on the screen if it was otherwise hidden. And then forever, if whatever sprite this is touching our hero, the character in whatever game this is, add orange to inventory and then hide yourself. So this appears to relate to a sprite representing an orange. So this is Fruitcraft RPG that someone made. Let's take a look at this. And now finally do the programs get a little more interesting. So no sound to this one, but here we go. All right, and here I go. So arrow keys. Now, I'll be the first to admit that the first thing I did was I went straight for the orange here. It's apparently a picture frame of an orange there. Subtle difference. So I'm going to follow the arrow and go out the door. I'm just using the up, down, left, right arrow keys. Here I am on another screen. There's a real orange. And notice at top left, that's sort of like a bucket that's showing me what's literally in the array as well as its current size. Now cherries. Well, let's read the sign. Oh, nice. All right. So let's go over here to the pineapple and the bananas, the apple. I'm going to go into the fruit place. Oh, look at this. Very compelling stuff, yes? All right. So now let's get more sophisticated. And again, if I'm going quickly here, it's only so that we don't quickly lose ground to what's otherwise some minutia of either what the pieces look like or what you can do with them, but we'll see more examples still that are more interesting. So, threads. Now, this is where you sort of stop in an introductory course, even AP Computer Science most likely, short of talking about, because you can't really in the course of a semester, or at least with even some languages, talk about this idea. So, almost every computer that you've used in recent years can do multiple things at once. So you have Microsoft Word open, you've got Facebook open, your browser, you've got AOL Instant Messenger open, you've got Outlook or something else open. Your computer is doing multiple things at once, and yet many of you only have one CPU or one core, so to speak, in your computer. Now, if we already talked, if briefly on Monday, that a CPU is like the brain of a computer, how could a computer be doing multiple things at once if really there's only one brain there? And yet you seem to be, again, running multiple programs. Well, what computers are very good at, or specifically what operating systems, Windows, Mac OS, Linux, are very good at these days, is creating the illusion to humans, which, relatively speaking, are pretty slow-witted compared to computers, the illusion that that computer is doing multiple things at once. But what's really happening is that your computer is offering time sharing to all of these various programs. I mean, your CPU, even if you don't really know what it means, you probably know that you've got like a CPU that's a gigahertz or 2 gigahertz, and that's fast. It's a billion something, or it's 2 billion something. Well, that's 2 billion operations or decisions that the computer can make per second. So what does that mean for your programs? Well, if you have that many cycles at your disposal, well, you can run Microsoft Word for like a couple milliseconds, and then you can switch to AOL Instant Messenger for a couple seconds, maybe receive an instant message, show it, and then go back to dealing with whatever's in the Gmail window. In short, you have so many cycles to spare these days, your computer can create the illusion to you that it's doing all of these things at once, when really, it's doing just one thing in series, but just very fast. Now, this is a bit misleading these days, because how many of you, even if you have no clue what it means, recently bought a computer that's dual core? Okay, that's pretty good, right? You got dual core computers. What does that mean? Right, it effectively means you've got 2 CPUs, although it's really 1 CPU with like 2 brains in it, just because that tends to be more cost effective and you can just get away with it. And nowadays there are quad core machines, and quite soon even more than that will be popular. And what that means is that your computer can now do literally twice as much stuff as, say, the predecessor could. Well, Scratch is actually a multi-threaded programming environment. A thread is like a miniature program that can be run alongside of, or really in parallel to, other threads or other mini programs. And this is how Scratch is able to be so interactive, and it can do so many things at once. You can have the cat moving, you can have other things moving. For instance, the robot example we saw on Monday, where the robots were all going back and forth. Well, those were 4 different robots moving around, even in Oscar time. Oscar was popping out of his can and going back down, trash was falling, umbrellas were falling. Lots was happening at once. And this is because Scratch is multi-threaded. It can handle multiple threads at once. Well, how can we see this in action? Well, let's look at a program first that's just a single thread. So this is move1.sb, and this is simply a program that has, notice, just 1 script and 1 sprite.
Ah! Ah! Ah!
These aren't the kinds of programs you're going to download and play with for very long. But we clearly have an example of what here? This is just an example of a loop, right? And I made the annoying decision to add a condition that says if you're touching the edge, play the scream male true sound, turn 180 degrees, and repeat. Again, ad nauseum. Well, this is just 1 thread. There's really nothing else going on. So let's look now at move2.sb, which is interesting because it now has both this cat and also this bird. And notice if I click the different sprite, you see their respective scripts. So each palette in the middle is unique to whatever sprite happens to be clicked on. So let's go ahead and play this one. You can kind of see where this is going, right? So, not the nicest conclusion, but not only do we have 2 things moving at once, although really it's the cat's taking a tiny step, the bird's taking a tiny step, and it creates the illusion of animation happening simultaneously. Well, what's happening here? So it looks like the bird, when the green flag is clicked, goes to like -150, 150. So this, like a Cartesian coordinate system, is an x-axis and a y-axis, and I think 0, 0 is in the middle or thereabouts. Yeah, 0, 0 is in the middle. So it goes up, down, left, and right. And so you can use this to pre-position some of the sprites. So that's what the bird is doing. He's pointing in degrees, 45 degrees, and then forever doing the following. If I am not touching the cat, so you can interact with other sprites clearly, move 3 steps, like 3 pixels, but if you're on the edge, bounce. And this is one of the relatively rare blocks in Scratch where it's kind of a condition and a statement all combined, because it just is a common one to use. Meanwhile, the cat didn't seem to be operating totally independently, right? The cat is awfully good at keeping track of where the bird is actually going. So he's not just wandering aimlessly. So what is the cat doing? Well, this thread, this program that, just like the bird, is also executed when that green flag is clicked, is similarly operating independently. So this guy is going to a predetermined location, and I just did that to make sure they didn't start on top of each other and kind of spoil the demo. He's going to point in some random direction. So at least there's a bit of an attempt to make this look different each time, though clearly the pattern was similar. And then forever, the cat's going to say, if I'm touching the bird, play that lion sound and stop. So that kills the thread. It's like exiting the program. Else, and notice this is kind of implicit here, just because of the way of how I did this, point toward the bird, thereby getting his special advantage, and then move one step. And so what this has the effect of doing is making the cat chase the bird. But the takeaway is that now we have these two independent or semi-independent entities, dependent only insofar as the cat is cheating and actually trying to detect the bird, which Scratch allows it to do. So, what can we do further? Well, there's this other thing we can do with scripts, is they don't have to interact solely by means of touching each other, but rather, let's go to high 10, which is apparently not among our downloads. So let's go to the other visualization of this. Where would they all be? So let's just wing it. So this example here, which I clearly forgot to upload to the laptop, has two scripts, and it looks like what is going to happen? Oh, this is a good one. We can't spoil this one. All right. Let's actually get this one from... I'm going to do a little tangent. So this is our quick introduction to a program called SecureFX, which is a program with which you can download files from a server. This program is going to allow us to connect to an account, in this case, where the cs50.net's website is hosted. I'm completely trying to stall here. So we have in this particular folder set up here some lectures. We have several weeks, but only just one so far. We have some source code in here, and hopefully I had the foresight to put it in there, and I didn't, which means that example lives in a second location. So we'll now use this as an example of the course's website, because if I had the further foresight for plan C, I had, yeah, wow, okay, strike three, I'm out. All right. So what this particular example did, which I'm so sad we don't see, and I could recreate it, but we'll just waste time, had a picture of a seal on the middle of the screen, and all this seal did was play the sea lion sound, which was the, I'm not going to completely humiliate myself by simulating it, it makes the sound that the sea lion would make again and again and again. Yes, you're very disappointed, I know. All right, but on the left, notice what it's doing. There's one script here that's saying when the green flag is clicked, forever do the following. If muted equals zero. So just coming back to the constructs from before, what must this orange muted thing be? So it's a variable. So it turns out that with variables, not only can you store numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you can also simulate the idea of a Boolean variable, which is something we will see in C and other languages. We have the ability to just store the notion of true or false. So it looks like, in fact, this other script here, which is similarly defined to operate in this seal, and I'll upload it later to the website if you're curious, initializes that variable at top right to zero, and then forever does the following. What is the role in life of that right-hand script? It's just to toggle the value of muted from 1 to 0. So this was my attempt, if failed currently, to implement the idea of turning the volume on or off. So even though the left-hand script is the thing playing the sound again and again and again, the right hand is kind of just listening. And this is what's neat about threads. While one thread is sort of doing its own thing over here and playing the bark, bark, bark of a sea lion, this guy can be doing something completely different. But when he hears, for instance, the space bar pressed, he can very quickly check the value of this variable. And if it's zero, make it one. If it's one, make it zero. And the effect of that, because I declared this variable within Scratch to be a so-called global variable, is to influence the behavior of the left-hand script. So to be clear, you hit play, you're going to see the sea lion bark, 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 hit the space bar, and the bark is going to stop completely. And so this is an example of global states. So programs or threads can not only use their own sort of variables, they can also communicate. So it's only fair that you get to beat me now up for this demo that didn't work. I do need one volunteer to come on up. And this is only fair. Oh, you're the first to volunteer. Come on up. What's your name? Meryl, come on up, Meryl. You two need to be comfortable, to be clear, coming on up. This is David.SB, and I can't take complete credit. This used to be Amon.SB, one of the grad students at MIT who's been working on Scratch for some time. I just took his face out and put mine in. So what you'll have the ability to do here is to go left and right with the gloves, and then you can also punch me by hitting up and down. Yeah, really, I just hit it as many times as you. There you go. It's okay, keep going. Keep going. At some point, I think I turned purple. There we go. Keep going. Try your right hook. Hit the down key instead of the up. There you go. You're almost done. Oh, keep going. Okay. Thank you, Meryl. You can meet Jansu over there. All right. So we won't go through all the source code, but clearly there's multiple things now happening. Not just cat and mouse, but there's a right glove and a left glove, and then there's me, and then there's also this stage. And so there's a lot of interaction here because something was clearly keeping track of the score. So we actually see the variable, probably a global variable up top. Notice also that these gloves appear not to have just one script, but multiple scripts. And again, this speaks to the ability to be multi-threaded. These programs can be effectively doing multiple things at once. And this is a powerful thing, because clearly do the programs, if silly, at least get more interesting and get more interactive. Well, there's this one other construct that's kind of neat, and we've seen it, if briefly, but let's take a look at what this means with a simple example. So Scratch, like languages like Java and JavaScript, support very well this notion of event handling, where you, a program, can sort of tell the world, I am interested in the following happening. Now, for instance, in the context of a browser might be interested in knowing when the user hits the escape key, so it knows to close some window, like keyboard shortcuts in Gmail. Your computer might care about listening for mouse clicks in certain parts of the screen, so it knows to change whatever web page you're on. Well, similarly, can Scratch be programmed to sort of wait for something to happen? So don't do anything when the green flag is clicked, but do something when you hear or receive an event. So this example here is going to involve two sprites. It's a Marco Polo type example. So the boy sprite here is apparently forever, the moment the program starts, going to check, is the space bar pressed? And if so, say Marco for 2 seconds, and then, quote unquote, broadcast an event. So announce to the world something called event. Now, meanwhile, the girl sprite on the right is only going to operate when she receives that same named event, and she is going to simply respond with polo. So the example itself is not a particularly fun game to play, but what it does show is that one sprite with one script and this other sprite with a completely separate, if simpler, script can now interact, because if I hit the space bar, notice that that behavior is now influencing the girl sprite's behavior. So that, too, sort of hints at the kinds of things you can do. Let me go ahead and intentionally this time go back over to the course's website. And again, all of the examples we've been playing with will almost always be posted here. And let's take a look, for instance, at this. So this was made by a former summer student of mine, Carlos.
Hot dogs, beer, hot dogs.
So here, too, you can just kind of see him in his dorm room recording this into his microphone. If you click on the player, notice I missed the goal, but the goal is to get the sprite. Not so good. There we go. So in this game sort of repeats, but the takeaway for now is that you start to see these more sophisticated programs that even might look a little childlike, is there's a lot going on, right? There's a couple of sprites here, one or two with representing the goal and the target there. There's clearly one representing the ball. There's the whole stage, that is the soccer field. There's the player himself. So once you sort of get comfortable with some basics, can you actually build up from that and do more interesting things still? What's another one? We saw this last time. How about Tetris Survivor? So this is one of those crazy type scratch games. And notice now I'm playing these within the confines of the web browser. So you'll find that MIT made a Java plugin for web pages so you can play Scratch programs within their website, their gallery, but you can't edit them here. For that, you need to download the software as we did. So here we go. So I'm the purple block, and I need to move up and down and navigate my way only on the white blocks without touching any of the colored ones. So I, of course, practiced this before lecture to see how far I could get. Oh, and this is where I kind of died last time. Oh, not very good. But again, the programs are getting a little more sophisticated, lest you be underwhelmed, for instance, by some of those simplest examples. But let's take things one step further. So what's really neat about this environment, if not a little more complicated, is the ability not only to take user input from the keyboard and such, or the mouse, but also to take input from sensors. So this is an example of a logic board. It's sort of similar to Spirit to like a motherboard and a computer or an expansion card that you put into a computer. It's much simpler, but these things are called scratch boards, or these days Pico boards, because they're made by a different company, not the Media Lab. And it's got things like these alligator clips, which you can connect to things by just pinching them and then they latch on. It's got, I can actually connect over to this thing here. It's got on it this button. So this yellow button here is able to sort of send a signal, yes or no, is the button pressed. This thing with the ear next to it is an audio sensor, so it can actually hear a voice being spoken, if any. There's a light sensor by the eyeball here. There's this little lever that goes back and forth, which returns a value from like 0 to 100 to give your program a sense of where it is. And the interesting thing about Scratch is that you can actually take input from this device now, even connect this device to physical objects to create like your own joystick, for instance, hide it in something more visually interesting, and further control these programs. So the teaching fellows and I, in the past week, sort of all sat down to play with these boards for the first time, and we made a couple of interesting examples. One, though, is this one here that I believe comes with the Scratch distribution. So let's see if we can get this one to work. All right, so if this is wired up correctly already. Okay, so I look like an idiot now. Take two. Fix all of this in post-production. Now does that make more sense? Okay, so that's using the audio sensor, and it's picking up the strength of my voice, whatever the sound, still doing it apparently, whatever the strength of my voice happens to be. Well, what more can we take off of the sensor board? Well, what about this one here, using the light sensor, made by David Ramos, one of our teaching fellows? So I think his subtitle for this was, Why Harvard Students Shouldn't Go Out at Night. Very pretty. Very retro Nintendo-like. Now I'm going to cover the light sensor. Daytime. It's kind of fun. I did like 10 iterations of this before class. Anyhow. All right. So all fine and good. Can we make them more interactive still? So another one from one of the teaching fellows, this one by David Wu. So this is Ice Monkey. So I'm going to make it full. That it's got the whole like ice thing because it takes a little while to respond. The purpose of this game is to catch the bananas, as I learned only after trying to catch the basketball. But again, it doesn't quite respond very quick. Also, notice my monkey stun counter has gone up. I don't know how. See, I'm stunned again, and now. From Andrew Barry's program, and now this is usually where I die. You just start to get hammered. So by your the course's teaching fellow. So there are different blocks, that is to say, that are actually controlling these things. So let's pull up, for instance, Just one other. This one I made, not nearly as interactive, but this guy, notice, is just making use of all these blocks from the sensing bar. And there's not even that many, but there's a block here for the slider sensor value, a Boolean expression for is the sensor button pressed, question mark, and so forth. What's the loudness value? Now, this guy here was meant for me to be a demonstration of the alligator clip. So let's see if I got this right. So I'm going to go ahead and turn this on. I'm going to go ahead and not turn that on just yet, and I'm going to show you exactly sort of the vision I had. So when I actually made my first Scratch project at MIT, I was trying to sort of one-up myself with Oscar time. So the iteration of problem sets we had that year was make your first Scratch program not using these boards, and I made Oscar time. Then we had to use one of these boards and make it interact with something real world. So I thought, being the, you know, 20-some-odd year old I was, it would be fun to take a coffee can, take the tape off, take the wrapper off of it, go and buy for the first time in a while a stuffed animal from the local store, namely Oscar the Grouch, and put him in the physical can. And what I did was created a sort of real world Oscar time. I took my mom's salad tongs like this, and the goal of the program was to pick up trash in the real world, which I created by way of getting some tinfoil, rolling it up into a ball, so that I could then make contact at the ends of these things by picking up metal balls that were just made out of tinfoil, and then when you let go, you would then see the trash fall from the sky, very similar in spirit to the original Oscar time. So how did I begin doing this? Well, I thought I would try to encourage some creativity when it comes to the problem set. So not only did I take my mom's salad tongs, I took one of her lamps, a cable like this at the time, so this was the part that used to be into the lamp, but what I knew I needed was to somehow connect salad tongs to the Scratch board. The Scratch board, again, supports these alligator clips, so I figured, well, I could either wire up the alligator clips there, but then it doesn't really give me much length, so I just needed some wire. So I took an electrical cord, mind you, after unplugging it from the wall. This now is just two long wires, so I took a scissors or my knife at the time, kind of split the wires in the middle just to, so I could get the casing off of it. And again, the goal was just to get a couple of wires. So now I had these two sort of contacts at the end. Then you have to do this sort of thing. And then you have to do it again when you cut right through. All right, because this is just some rubber coating here. All right, so now that comes off. Now I've got an exposed wire. Let's do this again over here. This way. This was homework, right? How could this kind of homework not be fun? Cut through this. Again, this is not what we expect, to go cutting your halogen lamps cords open from your dorm rooms, but now I have two exposed wires here. So I went ahead and did what? Let's see, I got an electrical outlet here, electrical plug here. I didn't really need to chop that off because I can just connect the alligator clips to the end of this. I'll do the other one here. So now I just need to make contact with these two things. And my vision at the time was to actually run this wire the length of the thing and attach one to either side. You make contact with the tinfoil, the ball connects the two contacts, sends a signal to the Scratch board, which sends a Boolean signal, yes, touching, no, not touching, which Scratch then responded to by dropping the trash from the sky or not. Well, in this example, I thought I'd keep it a little simpler, since I actually couldn't find Oscar last night. So I will instead just play this program here. And if this demo works, ooh, dramatic with the lights, huh? Now that's not real electricity, that's the sound of electricity coming from my laptop. But how does this work? Well, all it took was this. So when green flag clicked, forever, if sensor number A, letter A on the board, out of A through D in this case, play the sound, electricity, until done. And again, we can be a little silly here. If we instead, oh, we could do explosion apparently. So we can choose explosion, play this one instead, touch the two contacts. And similarly, can you interact with the real world? So what does that allow us to do? Well, it's going to allow you, in the case of problem set zero, to actually interact with the real world. But let's first consider how you would go about starting one of these things, right? It's fine to sort of do these simple cookie cutter examples like hello world or hi world. And then very quickly did we, even with these demos, sort of go way past ourselves, showing something like David Wu's example with Ice Monkey, which kind of suggests perhaps to those less comfortable, where would you even begin to implement something like that? So it's kind of the design process at this point that's now a little more interesting. So we have, in this case, Oscar time, a screenshot thereof, and there were different components to Oscar time, right? There was the trash that fell from the sky. And initially, there was just one such piece of trash. There was also Oscar himself, which occasionally popped out of his can and went back in. So that sort of suggests another sprite. And then there was all of those other things, the phone and the alarm clock and the umbrella and the shoe, all of which were separate sprites. And if you sort of try to do everything at once, certainly if you're programming for the first time, it's going to be kind of overwhelming. And odds are it's not going to actually work. But if you instead try to take bites out of programs, whether it's with Scratch or next week in C, can you make things a lot more manageable? So for instance, the very first thing I decided to implement was just the trivial aspect of the instructions. And the instructions, recall, only displayed for a few seconds, and then that was it. So the instructions for me were like a sprite or the stage. So all I had to do for this sprite, which is literally just that picture that I made with Photoshop or some similar program, I went to 0, 0 so that the thing would be centered. And again, we're talking about the image, the GIF or the JPEG or whatever that is. I show it, I stay there for 4 seconds, and then I go away. Done. Sort of cross that item off the to-do list, displaying the instructions. Now, making trash fall takes a little more ingenuity, but think about what must be going on. We have a sprite that, by default, who knows where he's going to start. So we need to put him somewhere specifically. So at top left there, I first hide the sprite, lest the trash appear in the middle of the sky for no reason. I point in direction 180, which is straight down in this case. I then go to a random X location from negative 100 pixels to 200. And I just figured that out by trial and error, by seeing where I wanted the trash to fall, because I didn't want it to fall right on top of Oscar, because it's kind of a stupid game if you just watch the trash fall into Oscar's can. So why, though, I wanted to be at 180, so it would start from the sky, so to speak. Then I waited for 4 seconds, because that's my sort of synchronization with the instructions that as a separate thread would be running simultaneously. I show myself, I being this piece of trash, I go to the front, so there's this notion of foregrounding things and backgrounding, like windows. Then I forever do the following, and ignore almost everything except for the middle part for now. So the very first thing I did was, let's just make the trash fall. So I had a loop, and so I moved one step, and that's all I wanted it to actually do. But then I needed to get more interesting. I needed to be able to detect, is, for instance, this piece of trash being clicked on? In other words, is the mouse down? And am I touching that mouse? Because if you kind of think ahead, if there's multiple pieces of trash falling, you've kind of got to be able to distinguish between one or the other. And so I realized only after several hours on a Friday night that I actually needed a couple of variables, a couple of global variables, so that all of my different sprites could actually distinguish between them being clicked on versus another piece. Because if you kind of extrapolate with what might be going on here, what I didn't want to happen was the following. I click the mouse on a piece of trash, and it attaches itself to my cursor, like the game was being played. I drag it across the screen. Suppose I accidentally drag it on top of another piece of trash. I didn't want that sprite as a separate thread to realize, oh, I too am being clicked on, because then what you would get, and this just wasn't what I wanted, these clumps of trash all sort of catching onto your cursor, and maybe that's a feature. I sort of wanted to avoid that. And so I needed to be able to distinguish, is it my click? Is it some other sprite's click? And so after, you know, a bunch of iterations, I realized, all right, I'm going to have some variables called my click, which means it's one if I've been clicked on, a good click variable, which is global, which just says someone has been clicked on. But these were the kinds of issues or bugs that I initially encountered. I quite literally had a bug initially where I dragged the trash and then everything stuck to it, because I hadn't really thought about what it means to write a multi-threaded program, which itself, though in Scratch, is a fairly sophisticated idea. Well, what about dragging itself? Well, this one actually wasn't that bad because of the way I had designed things. I just had to forever check with this another script, if the mouse is down, just go to the mouse. Right? If the click is down, just follow the mouse. So that was the idea of picking up a sprite. Just stay touching the mouse pointer in that case. Well, what about a time limit? Well, this didn't really so much involve a loop as it did sort of figuring out exactly how long I wanted the program to go. Because the song, as I learned the hard way, was of a fixed length of time. And so I wrote this script, when the green flag is clicked, set the costume on the Oscar sprite to be Oscar 1, then play the sound called soundtrack. Apparently, I guess I lied, it wasn't 90 seconds, it was 134 seconds, that particular game. And then notice all of these waitings and settings of costumes. And this was the means by which Oscar, at the end, knew to pop out and proclaim what the total score was. It had been pre-scripted. Well, what else is there? There was the idea of keeping score. So to keep score, I actually needed to be able to maintain some variable. And so similarly, was there a script checking every time a piece of trash touched not the mouse, but Oscar himself, do the equivalent of a plus plus. And similarly, when that happened, did I want the trash can, the lid, to be raised? So how does this actually connect and relate to, for instance, C itself? Well, this again is the simplest perhaps of C programs. It's the canonical hello world, or in our case, oh hi world program. The same program in Scratch is quite literally, typo aside, since I apparently wasn't elite enough to get the Scratch version right, the Scratch block just takes two. And this is one of the reasons we introduce it, not for the duration of a semester, but for this first week. Because it's much easier to sort of get oneself up to speed and start having fun writing programs in this environment, as we've even seen with some demos, doing things like that at top right, but it's on Monday, we'll go to bottom left. Well, what are we going to see when we get into C? We're going to see the equivalent up top in Scratch, simply written as the slightly more cryptic printf, open parenthesis, quote unquote, oh hi, backslash n, close quote, close parenthesis, semicolon, which on the first day of any computer science, I would argue, is rather mind-numbing to dwell on. Now you put the semicolon, now you put the parenthesis, now you quote everything. Very quickly do you lose sight of the purpose of it all, which is the ideas and the actual achievement of some vision you have. Boolean expressions, which in Scratch look like that up top, next week are going to start to look like this. A little more cryptic, but actual less than signs, and, two ampersands to represent the word and, but otherwise it's going to be the exact same idea, the same principle. Condition, a little scarier, but same idea. On the left, we have something that might appear in Scratch. If x is less than y, say x is less than y. Else, if x is greater than y, say x is greater than y, and so forth. Well, in C, it's going to look like this. But again, the syntax at that point, having played with these things in the form of Scratch, should be, yeah, a little cryptic. Maybe you might make some stupid mistakes, like forget a quote mark, forget a semicolon, and you all will, ourselves included. But not such a big deal, because that's not really the essence of what it means to be writing this stuff. What about loops? Well, in Scratch, we're going to see a forever loop like that, or a repetition loop like this. Well, in C, it's going to become while one. Because what that means there, the parenthetical expression, one is always true, because one is always one. So that has the effect of inducing an infinite loop, which, though sometimes a mistake, is sometimes valuable. The bottom there is an example of iterating some fixed number of times. Variables, too, what we might have with these orange blocks at top left are simply going to become the syntax like that at side right. Arrays. Arrays, too. In a single orange block to add the word orange, well, on the right-hand side, it's going to be more cryptic, and we'll spend some decent time on what the star means and what the square brackets mean, because these are powerful tools and tricks that you can also do a lot of damage with, but there's some interesting ideas underneath them all. But the syntax shouldn't be such a big deal. Well, what are you actually going to do? Well, the course's first problem set is due next Friday, and it comes in two editions, so to speak. So per the syllabus, we will release some problem sets in a standard edition, so to speak, which we mean for most students in the course, 70%, 80%, 90% of the students in the course. That is sort of the problem set. But for those of you who are coming into the course with more savvy, with more experience, not just AP Computer Science, but maybe you've been programming since you were 6 years old, but there's some stuff in the syllabus that you've just never touched before, or you kind of want the structure of a course to teach you C and pointers and the like, well, for you all, there are going to be these things called hacker editions, which are going to cover essentially the same material, but from a more sophisticated angle, a more technical angle. You won't get extra credit for these outright, but you will be, we hope, more stimulated and challenged. But to be clear, we expect most students to do the standard edition of these problem sets. The hacker edition of these problem sets this particular week will make use of these Scratch boards. So whereas last year we had everyone do the standard edition, so to speak, we were lucky enough to get funding from the School of Engineering to buy about 180 of these things this year. And they weren't cheap, and so we're going to try to be careful with them. But what we will do, starting with office hours tomorrow on Thursday, as well as next Tuesday and Thursday, and also perhaps this weekend, we'll figure something out. We'll post announcements on the website. We'll loan these out to you, and you will see in the PDFs that will be posted by 7 p.m. tonight what the two problem sets are, standard edition versus hacker edition. To be clear, in addition to dropping students' lowest problem set score, you also have late days, 9 late days, so to speak, which are sort of self-governed extensions that you can give yourself, but more on that in the syllabus. Now, I made you one last project, if I could. The folks at MIT preach a lot in a very good way about Scratch is this ability to remix Scratch projects. Take elements from one that you like, another that you like, sort of learn from them and make something altogether new. So I went ahead and made this one as sort of our finale for this week zero. It's about 30 seconds long.
Monday.